The following program was produced by Classical 89 in cooperation with the BYU Division of Continuing Education.
I'm Sharon Swenson of the Department of Theater and Film at Brigham Young University. In the next hour, we're going to be talking about Eliza R. Snow, pioneer, poet, and oracle. With me today are Michael Hicks, professor in the School of Music at BYU, and Jill Mulvader, Managing Director of the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute for Latter-day Saint History at BYU. We're looking today and talking about Eliza R. Snow. Most Latter-day Saints know her as a writer of hymns, but she did much more. Jill, can you give us a little more background?
She was a gifted writer of hymns, but the hymns were a small part of her poetical output. She actually wrote well over 500 poems. And I think many people know her as a poet, but forget the other important aspects of her life. She was president of the Relief Society from 1868 until 1887 and made an important contribution to the church organizationally. So she was important as a poet and important organizationally, as well as a friend and a loving minister to many, many men and women in the church. Actually, she lived longer than most people during her era. She lived for 83 years. She was born in 1804 in Beckett, Massachusetts, the daughter of Oliver Snow and Rosetta Pettibone Snow. They were staunch New Englanders, but among those who left New England, they left for the Western Reserve in 1806 when Eliza was very young. The Western Reserve was in what came to be known as Ohio. They settled in Portage County and eventually had seven children. Eliza was the second daughter of four daughters, and their last three children were three sons. Eliza's younger brother, Lorenzo, was 10 years younger than she, and Eliza Snow and Lorenzo Snow were very close throughout their lives. She loved Ohio. She wrote many poems about the beautiful world there she grew up in, the trees, the sky, all things that she loved. Nature, as we'll see in this discussion, was a recurring theme in her poems. She started writing verse as a young girl and sometimes wrote her school lessons in verse. She published her first poem at the age of 21. She was about 26 years old when she first encountered Mormonism, first met Joseph Smith in the winter of 1830-31. But didn't join the church for about 4 years and then became thoroughly committed as a Latter-day Saint, wrote two hymns for the first hymnal, and then later began serving as something of an official poet for the saints in a way. Joseph Smith seems to have commissioned her to write poetry for and on behalf of the Mormon people. And she did that very well for nearly 50 years. Starting in about 1838, she started writing poems chronicling the history of the saints, celebrating special events or institutions. She wrote a poem for the building of the Nauvoo Temple, for example, or a poem about the Nauvoo Legion, many trail poems, and poems celebrating the saint settlement in Utah, in the state of Deseret. She loved to celebrate in her anthems and songs. She wrote dozens of poems for individual people, poems of friendship, poems for funerals. She wrote lots of theological works. She liked to sit down and contemplate, reflect, write a little about theology, and published her first book of poems in 1856 and a second in 1877. And both of them describe, I think, the range of her poetry, hymns, religious, political, and historical.
That's a great way to understand something about her role as a poet. We've added oracle to describe her in addition. Michael, can you help us understand the oracular function of Eliza R. Snow?
An oracle to me in Greek culture was that woman in the community or in the culture of the society whom one would consult to know the future, to know destiny, to know the condition of the people at a given time. She was a woman who was attached to someone who was a great leader or was completely unattached, but pure and noble, and was visionary, transcendent in a lot of ways, could see from an aerial perspective what was actually going on behind the scenes, one might say, or from really a divine perspective. I think that what I see with Eliza R. Snow in her poetry, certainly, is that she is speaking very often for God. And that's a term that, you know, we use the term oracles to refer to church leaders and general authorities in particular. But that sort of larger, more general sense of, one who has the spirit and can speak in really more perceptive terms and tones than just regular folk.
One of the instances I think that a lot of Latter-day Saints know would be "O My Father," a poem which became a hymn. Now, that is included today in the current hymn book. Can you tell me a little bit about its background, Jill?
Eliza composed "O My Father" in the fall of 1845. This was more than a year after the death of the prophet Joseph Smith, and probably within a few days of the death of her own father, Oliver Snow. I think the poem reflects her commitment to the culminating doctrines taught by Joseph Smith in Nauvoo, the idea of premortal life and an existence with the eternal parents after this life. Those were exhilarating ideas for her and people in Nauvoo, and comforting. My sense is that as she contemplated the death of her own father, to whom she had been very close, served as his personal secretary when he was a justice of the peace in Ohio, obviously very close to him in terms of thought, and lived in his household until she was 38 years old. Very, very close to her parents. So I think there was a lot of sorrow connected with his death. And one of the ways she was able to address that was to think about this great perspective that Joseph had provided about the meaning of life, the significance of earth life, and the hope of eternal life with father and mother in heaven following this life. Now, the poem doesn't address specifically her earthly father, but I think one can assume that as she thought about him, her thoughts turned to that eternal home and her eternal father, and as we learn in this poem, her eternal mother.
The poem was written as a poem and then adapted as a hymn, and we've got several versions I'd like to listen to. Probably the most familiar one is the version that is currently in the hymn books, and we've got a 1910 Tabernacle Choir recording of that version.
Oh,
think part of the reason it struck such a chord with people was the simple constancy of death in the everyday experience of Latter-day Saints. And, of course, you see that in many of Eliza's poems. So many of these 500 are written on the occasion of someone dying, written to someone who is grieving. And it was a part of life that we just are so aloof from nowadays. But those Latter-day Saints had death as a constant companion. They sing about it. They talk about it. They meditate on it. And, of course, they have to deal with it all the time. And so this connection that these poems, and that poem in particular, My Father in Heaven, would make with people is really a natural part of the cultural landscape.
Well, one manifestation of the fact that it touched so many people is the fact there are so many different musical settings for it.
I think that the reason there are so many settings, of course, is that people wanted to find just the right setting, because the poem really did capture people's hearts and imaginations. And to find one that would fit the mood, there's not even a single mood in the poem. It does move through different sort of scenarios. And finally, the one that was settled on that's so familiar and became really popularized by the Mormon Tabernacle Choir specifically in the early part of this century is one that's sort of hypnotic in a way. And so on. It's a tune called My Redeemer that was found in gospel hymn books of the late 19th century. And I think it's because it's almost sort of droning and focusing. I've said before, it's like a hypnotic induction. And so the music doesn't get in the way of the text as some of the other settings had done.
Let's hear one of the other settings. There's one simple one called Gentle Annie. Can you tell us about what Gentle Annie was?
Well, that's a Stephen Foster song, and that tune was favored by Brigham Young, at least, and I don't know who else. But he was enough. If Brigham Young favored it, that was enough to make it a favorite of the Latter-day Saints. And I think that it's one of the nicest settings because you'll hear it in the second half of each verse. You'll hear a sort of a shift in the melody that keeps a sense of, gee, here's a new awareness or a new thought about to come into being.
Okay, let's listen to Oh My Father with the melody Gentle Annie.
Oh my Father, thou that dwellest in the high and glorious place, when shall I regain thy presence?
When I joined the church in 1973, there were two different tunes to Oh My Father in the hymn book, and I didn't know which was the proper one, the approved one. And I think partly because I was a new convert, I thought, well, this sort of heroic-sounding one, Oh My Father, thou that dwellest in the high and glorious place, that's the way I sang it and the way I learned it, and then I found out that was not the way it was sung. So there's so many different takes on the song, and that's why there have been so many different tunes, is that so many different ways to interpret it and construe its message.
One of the ways I think is most interesting is the Japanese version of Oh My Father. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it is the familiar tune we know, but sung by Japanese saints, and they sing it in Japanese. And I guess it's important for us to recognize that the feelings and the thoughts are translatable. It's not just the you know, proprietary interest of an American poet, but it's a universal message.
Comes back to the oracular function to a degree, that she's speaking what many feel.
Oh, I think so. I think she's universal now through the church's universality.
You know, it's curious listening to that. I know that they're singing Japanese, but my mind fills in the words. They're so familiar. I hear the English words. Mm-hmm. Very interesting to hear. Now, Oh My Father was a Nauvoo poem. What are some other poems from that same period, Jill?
There are nearly 100 poems from the Nauvoo period. It was a very productive period for her. One that I think is particularly interesting is one ballad that she titled The Arrest or Kidnapping of Lieutenant General Joseph Smith on the 23rd of June, 1842. The Lieutenant General refers to his rank in the Nauvoo Legion. He was arrested by Jackson County, Missouri sheriffs on some trumped-up charges and later released. But this has a particular appeal, I think, because of the images that it presents and the story that it tells. Let's listen to it.
Like bloodhounds fiercely prowling, with pistols ready drawn, with oaths like tempests howling, those kidnappers came on. He bared his breast before them, but as they hurried near, a fearfulness came o'er them. It was the coward's fear. "Death has to me no terrors," he said. "I hate a life so subject to the horrors of your ungodly strife. What means your savage conduct? Have you a lawful writ? To any legal process I cheerfully submit. Here, said these lawless ruffians, is our authority," and drew their pistols nearer in rude ferocity. With more than savage wildness, like hungry beasts of prey, they bore in all his mildness the man of God away. With brutish haste they tore him from her he loved so well, and far away they bore him with scarce the word farewell. Their conduct was unworthy the meanest race of men, would better fit the tiger emerging from its den. Missouri, oh, Missouri, you but prolong your shame by sending such as Reynolds abroad to bear your name. So much ferocious nature should join the brutish clan and not disgrace the features that claim to be a man. But hear it, oh, Missouri. Once more the prophet's free. Your ill-directed fury brings forth a jubilee.
A couple things worth mentioning, too, about this poem are, first, that she cannot get away from this oracular function because she's telling the story as a ballad will do, but then it becomes this address to Missouri and over and over telling Missouri how God views all of this and sort of proclaiming at the end, "Hear it, O Missouri, the prophet's free," and so on. The other thing, too, is that, as Jill mentioned, the collection of Eliza's poems was poems religious, historical, and political. And you hear all those things in this poem. You've got the history, of course, the storytelling, and the religious, certainly, and the political is always mixed up with the religious in Latter-day Saint history of the 19th century, anyway.
Well, one thing, too, that reminds me of is thinking about the way in which there were forms that the poems became part of the people because they'd be published on sheets that they could actually carry with them and have with them. I know the broadside that was published after Joseph Smith's assassination is one of those other poems that has the political as well as the mourning and the eulogy.
Right. I think in this long poem, one really hears the oracular voice that we have discussed here, the calling upon heaven. These are very stately lines written in blank verse and published, as you said, on a broadside that could be posted and circulated. We have found the lines written upon the assassination picked up in the journals of other Latter-day Saints for the period. As I say, a long poem written, we think, 3 or 4 days after the assassination and a great tribute to Joseph and Hiram Smith. The full title of this poem is rather majestic, The Assassination of Generals Joseph Smith and Hiram Smith, First Presidents of the Church of Latter-day Saints, who were massacred by a mob in Carthage, Hancock County, Illinois, on the 27th of June, 1844.
Ye heavens, attend. Let all the earth give ear. Let gods and seraphs, men and angels hear. The world's on high. The universe shall know what awful scenes are acted here below. Had nature's self a heart, her heart would bleed at the recital of so foul a deed. For never since the Son of God was slain has blood so noble flowed from human vein as that which now on God for vengeance calls from freedom's ground, from Carthage prison walls. Great men have fallen and mighty men have died. Nations have mourned their favorites and their pride. But two so wise, so virtuous, great and good, before on earth at once have never stood since the creation. Men whom God ordained to publish truth where ere long had reigned. Thou God of Jacob, in this trying hour, help us to trust in thy almighty power. Support thy saints beneath this awful stroke. Make bare thine arm to break oppression's yoke. Ye saints, be still and know that God is just. With steadfast purpose in his promise, trust. Girded with sackcloth, own his mighty hand, and wait his judgments on this guilty land. The noble martyrs now have gone to move the cause of Zion in the courts above.
That opening, of course, is purely Homeric. It's really at her most elevated state, because this was not just religious, political, historical tragedy, but it was a personal tragedy, too.
Well, there's also the way in which writing it and getting it published 3 or 4 days after the death, it would seem she found writing poetry was one way to deal with her emotions, to give voice to the grief and to share it.
She said to friends later that her poems often took her a great deal of time and thought. So while she could have probably written this quickly, I don't think she just tossed it off. Mm-hmm. I think there was some care. And as Sharon has mentioned, a great deal of personal feeling in this poem and in others. She wasn't an expressive person in terms of her emotions. I think we find more of her emotions in her poetry than in many other of her writings. She made good use of texts, and I think we sometimes have to be careful readers, even of these texts, to see the feelings in them. But in this, much is evident. As we move forward in time to 1846, when the saints left Nauvoo, she began writing a different kind of poetry, little songs for the saints on the trail, which are certainly far simpler than the mm-hmm. elevated lines that we've just considered. Maybe we should take a look at some of those.
This song, Let Us Go, is one of a whole series of songs based on an old tune called The Indian Hunter, where the Indian was singing about, let me go to my home in the far distant west, and so on. And you see different versions by Eliza and other poets. This particular one, I think, exemplifies what Jill is talking about.
Government where the just rights of protection we never can share, where the soil we have purchased we cannot enjoy till the time when the waster goes forth to destroy. Let us go, let us go. Extending abroad, where the priesthood again will exhibit its worth in the regeneration of heaven and earth. Oh, let us go to the far western shore, where the bloodthirsty Christians will hunt us no more. Where the shout of salvation be heard the world around.
Again, this kind of a trail song really demonstrates how Eliza could function as an oracle. She's articulating, moving, giving people what they need to go to the next step as they're leaving the beautiful city of Nauvoo and going into a place they don't know much about, heading into the west.
Yes, and one thing I like about Let Us Go is it not only looks back to the difficulties that the saints are leaving behind, but it looks forward to the future they can anticipate in a place of refuge. And the very sense of this group being the Camp of Israel, which they titled themselves, and several of her songs were written for the Camp of Israel, gives you the sense of heading to a promised land, being God's people with a place to go. So they're taking refuge from the difficulties they've had, but a new land of promise lies ahead in the future. I think we can pick up some of that in this journeying song that was written in 1847.
We'll find the land the prophet saw in vision when he said, there will the celestial law be given and obeyed. Thou camp of Israel, onward move, O Jacob, rise and sing. These saints the world's salvation prove, all hail to Zion. Saints, the world's salvation prove, all hail.
hear in that, of course, that they're singing to the tune of Auld Lang Syne, and I guess that's been implicit in some of the things we've already said, that a poem that was meant to be sung was typically not to a new tune, but to be sung to a familiar tune so that people could immediately begin to sing it together.
Well, now, it's very clear how, as the saints left Nauvoo and began moving, Eliza would function. Her work would help them go. What happened after they settled in what would become Utah, Jill?
Well, it's very, very much the same thing. She is invited on many occasions by Brigham Young, as she had been crossing the plains, to write a hymn for a particular occasion, not just the campfire setting, as was so frequent in that journey, but for special occasions such as the 4th of July or 24th of July. I really like what she wrote in her life sketch with respect to her writing of so many songs for those occasions. She wrote, "In this early time, poets were not as plentiful with us as at present, and I was expected to furnish one song and sometimes more than one for each of these occasions." And then she talks about a particular occasion in 1852 when federal officials had been in Utah, the first appointed federal officials had been in Utah the previous year and then left and taken with them the federal funds, and the saints were delighted to see them go. She writes, "It so happened that the government officers, and their names were Brockus, Day, and Brandeberry, absconded in 1852, just before we had a mammoth celebration of the 4th. Our first tabernacle having been completed did honor to the occasion. In composing a song for this celebration, prompted by the circumstances of the times, I indulged in the ludicrous, adopting the measure and also the tune of Old Dan Tucker, in which it was sung and called for the second time, creating a considerable merriment in the audience." Let's listen to this song dedicated to Brockus, Day, and Brandeberry.